welcome to Talking History and our special Thanksgiving show. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In today's show, we'll be exploring the history and meaning of one of America's most prominent icons, Plymouth Rock. Robert Arner will be joining us to help separate fact from fiction when it comes to the Rock's history as well as the meaning of Plymouth Rock to generations of Americans. But before we talk to Dr. Arner, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1910, Mexican reform leader and apostle of democracy, Francisco Madero, began an armed movement against Mexican dictator Porfirio Diaz, an advocate for the thousands of dispossessed farmers in Mexico's countryside at the turn of the century. Madero was one of the earlier outspoken critics of the Diaz regime. He initially supported independent political parties as a way to bring about reform, but soon turned to violence to accomplish change. Joining forces with other insurgents like Emiliano Zapata, Madero succeeded in toppling the Diaz regime in May 1911 and became Mexico's first popularly elected president. Under Madero's leadership, the country experienced freedom of speech and press. An agrarian commission charged with studying agricultural problems was formed, and reform proposals were discussed in the halls of government. But Madero was unable to quell continued unrest in remote farming villages, and his top general, Victoriano Huerta, turned against him, toppling him from power in February 1913. In the process, Madero was executed and martyred, leading to his being immortalized as Mexico's apostle of democracy. Turning to history in the news, nearly 20 years after chemical testing proved his so-called Hitler diaries to be fakes, German con man Konrad Kujawa is dead at the age of 62. Kujawa sold his forged books to a West German magazine in the early 1980s for $4.8 million, and the magazine published the 60 volumes believing they were authentic. It was only after their publication that German authorities exposed Kujawa as a fraud. They found that much of the diary was copied from the book Hitler, Speeches and Proclamations, 1932 to 1945. The American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom recently released its annual list of the world's most recognizable children's books, including The Catcher in the Rye and The Adventures of Huck Finn. While these books are normally noted for their literary quality, the ALA's list recognizes them for being among the 100 most censored children's books in American history and celebrated them during the association's Banned Books Week as a reminder of the threat of censorship in America. You're listening to Talking History. Plymouth Rock is one of America's prominent icons. Associated with the most hallowed of our European settlers, the Pilgrims, it is visited by thousands of tourists each year. We celebrate the Rock as well as the Pilgrims this week in our annual Thanksgiving celebration. What better time to re-examine Plymouth Rock's place in history? Here to help us do that is Robert Arner, Professor of English at the University of Cincinnati. Professor Arner is the author of Plymouth Rock Revisited, The Landing of the Pilgrim Fathers, which appeared in the Journal of American Culture. Welcome, Professor Arner.
Thank you very much.
Just to get us up to speed, very briefly, if you could you summarize the story of the Pilgrims for us?
Well, sure. They were a very small dissenting group of intensely religious people. Who believed that the Church of England had overstepped the ritual and symbol and ornamentation of true religious worship, and that there really wasn't that much to choose between the supposedly Protestant Church of England and the Catholic Church of Rome, which they despised. And they also didn't agree with the hierarchy, the bishops and archbishops and so on. In their reading of the Bible, the original brotherhood at the Last Supper was the model for the true church. And so they they shared that view, that anti-establishment view, with another group, which we know as the Puritans, but they were more radical in voicing it and actually declared themselves separate from the Church of England, which the Puritans were not to do for a very long time, and not till they were safely in America. And so they were persecuted and prevented from leaving, although eventually they did go to Holland, where they lived for about 20 years. Holland at that time was very hospitable to radical Protestantism, and especially anti-English radical Protestantism. But then they decided, because they were losing the language and their children were intermarrying and so on, that they wanted to go somewhere where nobody could intrude upon their solidarity. And so they settled somewhat reluctantly on this barbarous land of the wilds of America. And as every schoolchild knows, or used to know, they arrived in what is now the town of Plymouth in 1620.
Okay, well, how does Plymouth Rock figure into this story of religious dissent?
Well, it didn't. Not as far as any of the original sources are concerned, which are really to Mort's relation and then deriving from that, or having been used by the same basic document used, was Governor William Bradford's of Plymouth Plantation. And there's no mention of landing on a rock or anything like that. That all came later. And you can be pretty certain, if they had used it, that given their mindset, which was to look for symbols in everything, signs of God's approval or displeasure, that they would probably have found something to say about it.
All right, so what is the first historical reference that we have for the rock?
Well, it doesn't really show up until the 1740s, about a century and a couple of decades after the so-called first landing, which was actually the second or third landing, too, as far as that goes. But that's another story. In any case, it shows up as a boundary marker on a map of the town at the sea's edge. And also about that time, an elder of the Pilgrim Church, a man named from Spooner, who was then in his 90s, as the town was planning to build a wharf and remove the rock, came forth, had himself actually carried to the spot in a litter chair, and identified that rock as the place where the Pilgrims had first set foot, the first American piece of real estate, as it were. And Spooner had been a child when some of the original founding Pilgrim fathers like John Alden and Miles Standish were around. So people took that as gospel. But in a sense, everything about the rock since then rests on this man's frail memory.
Well, if it takes over a century just to have record of the rock, when did we actually start commemorating the Pilgrim landing?
Well, the Pilgrims began to be commemorated in the 1760s and early 1770s as part of First Landing Day. This was the brainchild of a group of people called the Old Colony Club, which was established mainly as a way of, descendants of the first comers of providing themselves with a kind of social barrier between their class and the latecomers, the illegitimate new settlers. But the club was also modeled on other clubs in the colonies and featured speeches and papers, and people wrote poems and stuff like that, presentations. There is an article coming out on that, but unfortunately it's coming out and I haven't seen it, by David Shields, who is an excellent scholar of this sort of thing.
Oh, well, look for it.
Yes, I will too.
Okay. It took 150 years, you're saying, before they even began to recognize the landing.
I would say, yeah, that's a good figure to...
And that also puts us in the era of the American Revolution.
That's right.
Any connection there?
Well, that's not coincidental. People were looking for ways to distinguish or validate their claims either as children of England or as sons of liberty. And so there was from the first in the Old Colony Club membership made up of both of those factions, and it was the Patriots who first saw the value of claiming the stone as an object of veneration for civil libertarians, and so they endowed it with a political dimension that it didn't, of course, have, even if Mr. Spooner was right in identifying it to begin with.
So the Patriots seized upon the rock to make it a patriotic symbol of the revolution at the time that they tie it to the Pilgrim Landing.
That's right. They actually proposed to lift it from where it was, move it out of the seashore and move it to the town square and place it next to the Liberty Pole, which was, of course, indisputably a symbol of civil liberties and rebellion against the crown and so on. And when they did that, the rock broke. So they took the top part, the larger part, left the other part in the hole, and did, in fact, move it into the town and used it as a symbol of the revolution.
So as long as you're heading in that direction, you give a wonderful account of the constant moving of the rock in your article. Why don't you just complete it till we get it back at its current site again?
Well, then, in 1820, with the 200th anniversary, there was a realization that maybe it should be rejoined to its original parts, and so it was also diminishing under the hands of tourists who kept chipping off pieces of it. And so the movement, I'm actually forgetting now whether this took place in 1820 or 1870 for the 250th, but in any case, they put it back on a cart, and it fell off and broke again. And so they took the two pieces and put them back in the hole with the original piece, cemented them together, put a brown marble canopy over them, which makes it 1870, protected it from tourists and gave it a shrine, a kind of chapel, as it were. That itself would be changed in the 1920s for the 300th anniversary when they replaced that with a neo-classic structure designed by McKim, Mead, and White.
Well, let me ask you, it's a bit puzzling. You've got a group that they were not the first European settlers in America, not even the first English settlers in America. And as you just indicated, the rock didn't seem to play any particular major role in this. How did Plymouth Rock, or for that matter, even the Pilgrims, manage to catch Americans' imagination?
Well, I think there are a number of explanations for that, actually. And might start with the Civil War. New England was on the winning side, and so the other competing claims, which were of Jamestown, obviously, here before Plymouth, were kind of discredited as belonging to a view of American society, which was anti-democratic, or various things that might have been said about it. But in fact, New England also, even before then, produced historians who wrote the histories concentrated naturally on their home states. People like Jedediah Morse, who was from Connecticut, but who could venerate a tradition as well as anybody, Myth of the Fathers. So I think it was a combination of Harvard-educated and Yale-educated historians, but especially Harvard-educated historians, controlling for the first few decades or even maybe first century of American history, controlling the press pretty much of the nation, and being committed to good promotions. Pretty much like today. I mean, it was they were quite serious about it, but it had established itself as a tourist attraction really by the 1830s.
Not to make light of it, but what you're suggesting here is that if the South had won the Civil War, and if they had had more prominent historians, perhaps out of the University of Virginia or William and Mary, then we might have been celebrating the first landing at Jamestown and Jamestown Rock or something along that line.
Well, I think, that may be stretching the case, because there isn't one, as far as I know, it being a marshy area, and of course the rock is, as a symbol that way, is so well adapted to the myth of the rugged New Englander too. It seems such a feature of an an imposing and not particularly hospitable landscape, which had to be tamed and so on and so forth. But yes, I mean, I think that that had a lot to do with it. If there had been established educational institutions other than William and Mary, if the South hadn't been educating its kids largely back in England, it could have faded. It could have remained nothing but. The same thing is true of Thanksgiving. I mean, it could have remained pretty much a local celebration and not spread to the rest of the country.
But both the Rock and Thanksgiving did become national, and they remained quite popular for over a century. Why do you think that is? Again, what is it about Thanksgiving, the Pilgrims, the Rock, that maintains that level of interest?
Well, that's also a difficult question to answer. Thanksgiving, was a harvest festival, I think, plain and simple, and an English custom to celebrate the harvest, which the Pilgrims quite naturally brought with them. It wasn't mythologized. The descendants of the Pilgrims at first picked it up as an alternative to Christmas, which they really distrusted and didn't want to celebrate as a pagan holiday or whatever. And so, again in the late 18th and early 19th century, lots of shops and stores and so on already having special sales of imported sweet raisins and so on, which they are tying to, great for Thanksgiving sort of thing. But it really wasn't until after the Civil War when members of Lincoln's cabinet, and they were all of them New Englanders, worked to get this institutionalized as a national celebration. So, the two, I don't know that you could say there's a very simple direct tie, but there certainly is an associational tie with the war between the states, if not to offend any Southern listeners.
Well, and certainly not to offend another interested party, the other group that would descend in the popularity here and on whom we've spent considerable time in past programs would be the Native Americans, who certainly don't see Thanksgiving
right.
in quite the same way.
That's right. In fact, I like Stan Freeberg's take on that from an old album he made in the late 50s, The United States of America, where the wife of White Cloud, who is the owner of Manhattan Island, who is bugging him to sell Manhattan to white men so she can get lots of junk jewelry, says, "Why don't we live in Massachusetts? He got, like your brother, he got invited to lunch." And the Indian, of course, says, "Big deal."
That's great. And I think we'll leave it at that. So thank you very much for joining us, Professor Arner, and have a nice Thanksgiving.
You're quite welcome.
You've been listening to Robert Arner, Professor of English at the University of Cincinnati. Our site of the week is related to Plymouth Rock. In fact, it is the home of the famous icon. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The famous Plymouth Rock is located on the waterfront in downtown Plymouth, near where the Mayflower II is anchored today, and about 2.5 miles north of Plymouth Plantation, the living history museum of 17th century Plymouth, Massachusetts. The nearby Mayflower II is a recreation of the famous ship that brought the first colonists, the Pilgrims, to New England in 1620. Previously, the Mayflower featured actors playing the roles of the English people who came over on the ship. The exhibit is now primarily a 20th century interpretation, with the actual restoration work on the ship becoming part of the exhibit. Of course, no trip would be complete without a visit to Plymouth Plantation, where there is plenty to see and learn about the early settlers. The plantation is open from April to November, and if you can't make it to Massachusetts, you can take a virtual tour of the plantation by visiting the website at Plymouth, plymouth.org.
Plymouth Rock is usually the subject of at least one question on tests given regularly to determine children's knowledge of history. Unfortunately, far too many get that question and other seemingly simple questions wrong. What are we to make of such tests? What do they really tell us about our knowledge of U.S. history? Here to give us his opinion on the subject is Norman Markowitz. Markowitz is a professor of history at Rutgers University.
Results of a recent survey of college students yielded the sad fact that the students know little about the facts of U.S. history, failing even to place the Civil War in its proper 50-year period. Senators Joseph Lieberman and Slade Gordon easily guided a resolution denouncing these results to the Senate. Some background information may help to explain this. First, the subject of history has traditionally been taught as facts, dates, and events, from grade school to high school to college. This approach alienates many students, who quickly forget the factual material they're forced to regurgitate. They remember instead the facts that Americans pay much more attention to, sports, music, movies, and television programs, where factual knowledge without contextual understanding can make people into quiz show millionaires. Modern mass media's presentation of current events and much of history to the general public in a series of headlines, sound bites, and news clips encourages a sensibility in which everything blurs into everything else. For many, the fictional facts of the intergalactic wars of the Star Trek TV series become as significant as the facts of the Civil War. A good example of historical interpretation following the ratings marketplace can be seen in the commercial cable network, the History Channel, which liberal critics jokingly call the Hitler Channel, since its primetime hours are filled with sensationalistic documentaries on Hitler and the occult, the sex lives of the Nazis, Hitler's generals, and the fate of Hitler's corpse. After Hitler, spy stories, war documentaries, and accounts of disasters like the sinking of the Titanic fill the primetime hours. Much of this is not the history that is being unearthed and written by contemporary historians, but it reaches a much larger audience through a much more powerful medium. Also, most historical research takes place in a university system which in reality separates teaching from research, rewarding the latter and neglecting the former. How much of that research is or can be a force in encouraging among the public an historical understanding of major social issues? John A. Hobson captured a central problem of modern mass education nearly 80 years ago when he wrote that those who in vague rhetoric dwell on education as the substitute for force and revolution often mean a doped, standardized, and servile education. Such education affords no safety in this dangerous world. Free thinking alone can furnish the energy and the direction to human government, helping to bridge the chasm between physical and moral progress. Today, mass media provide for the majority a doped, standardized, and servile education guided by a rating system. Education for the majority, defined as a commercial product to be sold to consumers, increasingly follows suit. This consumerist approach encourages many to dumb down curriculum and sacrifice creative and challenging approaches to the teaching of history. What is often lost in such an approach is students' ability to develop the intellectual tools to analyze the context of events, as well as teachers' challenge to make the facts both exciting and relevant to understanding the relationship of the present to the past. Historians and universities can make history relevant and exciting by rewarding interdisciplinary research and by encouraging historians' active involvement in the discussion of public policy. Then we may see a citizenry able to think about the causes and the consequences of the Civil War and to understand why they should know about it.
You've been listening to Norman Markowitz, professor of history at Rutgers University. His op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. Thank you. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we turn from one historic location to another and invite you to take a look at the historic neighborhood called Old City, Philadelphia, through a special exhibit recently opened at the Winterthur Library. Old City, Philadelphia, a historic neighborhood revisited, gives an overview of the city and the neighborhood, a look at some of the historical buildings, and a glimpse at some of the craftsmen and businesses that lined its streets in the 18th and 19th centuries. The Old City closes on January 12, 2001. Call the Winterthur Museum in Winterthur, Delaware, for further information. Last week, we discussed the life and death of Robert Kennedy. On the anniversary of the death of his brother John in 1963, the History Channel will re-air its five-hour documentary, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, a study of the various theories posed to explain the death of the nation's 36th president. It will air on November 26th, but be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will talk about the history of tears. That's right, crying. Have your tissues handy and join us. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.